is the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, China has just become the biggest buyer of Australian wheat. Will it mean higher prices for growers? And the Nationals say the Queensland government has failed as a lead agency to control fire ant. Not enough has been done, they say, to eradicate the pest, and more funding is needed immediately.
Now, this is an abject failure, not necessarily of federal governments and the other state governments, but only the Queensland government. They were given over $490 million to eradicate this pest, and they had it contained to a very small geographical area. But unfortunately, what happened is the Queensland government took the foot off the pedal, and this has just accelerated and exploded.
We'll hear more about that story shortly. Fire ant, you might want to comment on that on the text line. 0467 922 684 is the number to text me here at the Country Hour. But first up today marks a landmark in the long-running legal battle over cultural fishing rights on the south coast. Native title holders are filing a class action in the federal court against the New South Wales government for the continuing prosecution of traditional fishing practices that are protected under Commonwealth Native Title Law. ABC's Southeast Features reporter Vanessa Milton has been following the issue and spoke to Native Title holder Steve Clark and solicitors Tristan Gavin and Catherine Ridge.
For decades, the waters of the New South Wales South Coast have been a battleground, with Native Title holders facing prosecution for their traditional fishing practices, which come into conflict with the state's fisheries management regulations. Steve Clark, a Bidjigal Wadi Wadi Wandian man from Nowra, south of Sydney, says the fear of fines and jail time mean that he feels forced to give up on a tradition that goes back thousands of years.
I would have liked to continue to carry on those skills and teachings, but in doing so, I'm putting my sons and my nephews at risk of going to jail. It takes away my identity as a strong Aboriginal man.
Steve was taught to dive for abalone and lobster by his uncles as a child. As the eldest in his family, it was his cultural responsibility to provide for his extended family. By the time he reached his teens, Steve was being stopped and searched by fisheries compliance officers.
From then on, I was pretty much targeted. Every time I went to the beach or rocks or anywhere, I'd be there.
Steve is now 53. He gave up diving in his late 20s after being fined thousands of dollars and serving jail time over unpaid fishing fines.
It doesn't feel good. You know, it's like you're letting them down, you know, and you're letting yourself down, and then you can't provide, and you know, you really want to, but you can't, you know, without taking that risk of getting caught or going to jail. You know, when we go and get something, we provide for not only ourselves, but our family and our extended families, you know, like, that's how it is. Yeah.
After decades fighting costly battles over cultural fishing rights in local courts, Native Title holders on the New South Wales South Coast are now taking their legal battle to a new front. Today they will file a class action in the federal court, which could see over 10,000 people eligible for a compensation payout from the New South Wales government for the continuing prosecution of traditional fishing practices. They claim the state government's failure to recognise the native title rights of Aboriginal fishers is in breach of the Racial Discrimination Act and has had a devastating impact on health, family cohesion and the handing down of saltwater cultural practices across generations.
We believe that people deserve to be compensated and acknowledged for the wrongs of the past. A lot of people have expressed to us that these kind of prosecutions are having a real chilling effect on the practice of cultural fishing on the south coast. We're hearing consistently that a lot of people are just too afraid to get in the water.
That's solicitor Tristan Gavin, who is acting for the claim group, which includes over 10,000 Aboriginal people on the New South Wales South Coast. He has been involved in stolen wages and stolen generations class actions that have won hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation for Aboriginal communities. This legal action comes after a series of cases brought by the New South Wales government against Aboriginal fishers have been dismissed or withdrawn in local courts.
These are very long, difficult, expensive proceedings. There's a lot of wear and tear, not only on the South Coast community, but also on the fishery compliance officers that are involved.
That's Solicitor Catherine Ridge, who has successfully defended 14 South Coast native title holders facing prosecution over fishing matters. She believes the local courts are not the right place to test native title holders' rights.
The problem is at a much higher level, and I think the class action is better placed to deal with that injustice.
The class action is likely to take years to be resolved in court. But for Steve Clark, it is a chance to restore his culture and identity.
We are very resilient people. We're still here, but we're not going nowhere. We just have to keep fighting the fight and standing up for our rights and our future generation.
That's native title holder Steve Clark. And in a statement, a spokesperson for the New South Wales Minister of Agriculture said that these matters are complex socially and legally. The New South Wales government is working its way through them to ensure any regulation and enforcement balances the needs of fish conservation, cultural sensitivities and community needs. It's 11 minutes past 12.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Corakai and Pigabeen in the Tweed Valley, they've been declared a fire ant infested area following detection of a high-risk fire ant nest 1.2 kilometres across the Queensland border. Now, the federal leader of the Nationals, David Littleproud, says not enough is being done to eradicate the pest and it needs more funding to be injected immediately. And he told Donna Harper that the Queensland government has failed as a lead agency, and he's suggesting that a replacement needs to be appointed sooner rather than later.
No, it's not, and that's just not me saying, that's the Invasive Species Council. They believe there needs $200 million a year for the next 4 years. The federal government's only going to stump up an extra $200 million. Now, this is an abject failure, not necessarily of federal governments and the other state governments, but only the Queensland government. They were given over $490 million to eradicate this pest, not just by the Commonwealth, but by all the other states as well. And they had it contained to a very small geographical area. But unfortunately, what happened is the Queensland government took the foot off the pedal, and this has just accelerated and exploded across the border. And it's also up above the range in Queensland, which means it can get into the Murray-Darling. So it's not just on the coast of New South Wales we're really concerned about, but it's also up and down the east coast through the Murray-Darling. Just understand, medical professionals tell us if this spreads across the east coast, you could see an additional 140,000 presentations to doctors a year from these fire ants. In extreme cases, they can kill, but it'll mean your property basically unusable while you've got them there, and it'll also have a significant impact on agriculture. And so this is where we really have to do whatever we can to contain and eradicate as quickly as we can. Otherwise, we're really going to feel the impacts of fire ants, and the Queensland government's let us down. We need to put more money into this quickly and make sure that we're holding the Queensland government to account. If they can't do the job, then we need to find somebody else that can do it. But the investment needs to be put in quickly.
So when you're saying you don't think the Queensland government's handling it well and maybe find somebody else who can do it better, what's your suggestion there?
Well, this is where we need to see whether there's contractors that can be coordinated better than what the Queensland government. I mean, the Queensland government was the lead agency on this to contain and eradicate in southeast Queensland. And 4 years ago, they had it contained to a very close geographical area. And then all of a sudden, it's just exploded. It's exploded out within southeast Queensland, but across the border and up the range. So that means that the Queensland government wasn't doing their job with the hundreds of millions of dollars that Australian taxpayers were giving them to do it. They failed New South Wales, but they failed our country. And if we don't have confidence in what they're doing, then we need to find another agency or contractors that we can bring in and control and make sure that the boots on the ground, the work on the ground that's required is being done, because we're going to have to invest a lot more. We've invested a lot, but I can tell you this is frightening to think if this thing gets away from us. And this just takes real courage now of the federal government to take control. And obviously, I appreciate the New South Wales government is working as tirelessly as they can for what's happened on their side of the border.
Is this something that you're continually talking to the federal government about?
Yeah, look, I think this is something that Murray White knows full well is something that's got away from us as a nation, because we put faith in the Queensland government as the lead agency. They've let the country down, and it's now going to take more money and more leadership. And the Queensland government needs to be able to demonstrate that they have the capacity to eradicate. And if they don't, we've got to be honest and look for other measures if that's necessary. And if they exist, we should explore every avenue, because if we don't, it won't be just Northern New South Wales and South East Queensland that'll bear the brunt of this. The whole East Coast will have this, and then it'll spread right across the Nullarbor. So we've got a window of opportunity, but we've got to grab it, and we've got to listen to the experts like the Invasive Species Council, who have been quite forthright in their advice on what's needed and the amount of money that's required to eradicate.
So are you giving the Queensland government a certain time to see how they perform,
This is where you need leadership. You need leadership from the federal level, but in coordination with New South Wales. You shouldn't take anything off the table, but the window of opportunity is very narrow, and that's why the next 6 to 12 months is critical. Significant action in trying to eradicate as quickly as we possibly can. Otherwise, this will get away from us and we'll all pay the bill.
David Littleproud is the Federal Nationals leader and opposition spokesperson for agriculture. And on that fire ant issue, that, as I alluded to earlier, that detection, another detection occurring on Friday, just a kilometre over the Queensland border. Now, if you suspect fire ants, please contact the New South Wales DPI. For more information, you can visit their website, or you can call 1-800-680-244, 1-800-680-244. In regards to if you suspect seeing fire ants, get in contact with the New South Wales DPI. Another detection on Friday, just a kilometre over the border. It's 17 past 12.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
In northern New South Wales, farmers have tested their animals against others from across the country, looking for the ones that perform best in tough conditions. The 2024 New England Merino Sire Evaluation Association Field Day saw people come from as far away as South Australia and Western Australia. The trial allows breeders and producers to compare 900 progeny from a number of Merino sires that were put through a trial at Woodlands near Kingston, where a host flock was artificially inseminated. Association Chair Todd Willock told Lara Webster there was plenty to learn about where genetics in the industry are headed.
These sort of trials are absolutely, well, I see them as critical for evaluating sheep side by side, such a diverse array of genetics evaluated under exactly the same conditions. There's fantastic data that comes out of it, and it can feed into the National Merino Select database as well, as us producing the reports ourselves. It's such a great resource to draw on to see where genetics are heading, and it can give the entrants great insight into whether they could potentially shift things within their own flocks.
Jock Niverson is a sheep breeder just down the road at Walka and entered rams into the trial. He says taking part gives him a lot of insight into current genetics and how they cope with worm pressure in particular.
The New England sire evaluation is very unique. All the rest of the sire evaluations around the country are held in Mediterranean winter rainfall dominant and lower rainfall areas. So this site in particular is the site you want to send a ram to get a proper test for worms and fleece rot because of our high summer rainfall pressure on sheep. So it can be a challenging place for commercial people to run sheep, but I think it's an important place for seed stock people to be, because these sheep get a challenge year in, year out for worms and flies.
I've seen you and everyone else here going from pen to pen looking at these drops.
Yeah.
What are you seeing? I mean, what's standing out to you, and what are you learning about each of these? And I imagine they're all very different dependent on the genetics.
The merino industry is an interesting one. We've got a proud history and a lot of tradition in our industry, which we often don't want to let go of, but we also, at the same time, we need to be bold and aggressive with our genetics. You know, they're an important part of our industry, and they're an important part to add value the whole way through the supply chain. So you're seeing sheep that are from this area, they're expressing some traits, and then you're seeing areas from drier areas that are also, yeah, I guess handling this environment a little bit differently. But there is an excellent array of sheep here that cater to everyone in the industry, you know, no matter what path you're heading on.
Jamie Swales owns the Host ewe flock. For him, taking part in the trial means he gets an in-depth insight into genetics across the country.
We've learned a lot about assessing sheep, and also we're trialling 28 different bloodlines across our commercial flock and getting some really valuable genetic information out of it.
So tell me, what has been some of that valuable information you've gotten so far? I mean, you've got genetics from right across Australia here. That gives you a pretty in-depth insight or look at what's going on across the country.
Yeah, exactly. So these sheep are fully assessed. They're measured for micron fleece weight, body weight, all number of different traits and wool characteristics, and it's a really thorough look at each individual sheep to give us the result for the sire. So it's just a great opportunity to have a look at how different genetics affect our commercial ewes.
What are some of the differences that you can see?
Oh, you can really pick, you know, that once they're in their sire groups, you can see a big variation, which you would expect. I mean, we've got more meat orientated sheep to right through to super ultra fine wool sheep here, so that there is a really large variation, and which is a great aspect of the trial.
The objective here is to be able to breed a sheep with all of the genetics you want, so producing good wool, fly strike resistance, and so many other things. How close do you think this trial is getting to getting closer to what would be an all-rounder merino?
Oh, there's some standouts for sure. There's never a perfect sheep, but you know there's definitely trends. So yeah, there's definite, you know, some sheep here with really excellent characteristics across a lot of fields.
With ram genetics sent from Western Australia, South Australia and Tasmania, there was plenty to be assessed, especially for South Australian stud principal Alan Kelly.
We want to test our genetics in different environments. This New England environment is very, very different to ours. The altitude is higher, the rainfall is higher. The pattern of rainfall is quite different. It's seasonally opposite. We have most of our rainfall in a cold, wet winter. Up here, more of the rainfall comes in the warmth of summer. So we wanted to see what our sheep would do and how they would stand the harsh conditions in terms of worm burden in this environment. So it's really educational for us. It's a delight to see the local sheep. It's a delight to see what people are doing in this area. And it's a wonderful experience for us to see how our sheep have performed in this area.
What have you observed and made out of those assessments?
We've found exactly in some ways what we expected, that our sheep were very close to the wool types that we thought we would see, but that they would have a much greater body carcass growth, much more robustness in their ability to grow early and then taper off to not be a huge heavy animal at the end of its adult life. So we're really pleased with what we can see. They've done very well. They're way above average in terms of growth.
Are there some things you might like to see different as well, or things that you think might need a little bit of tweaking or you know, more work in terms of genetics?
I wouldn't dare to suggest anything on the site like this needs tweaking. I would take home that we need to get better at what we do. We're happy with where we've got to. There are things we can learn, and that's the way I look at this.
South Australian Merino stud principal Alan Kelly ending that report from Lara Webster. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's coming up to 25 minutes past 12.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, the delightful and intimate Mossvale Show was on over the weekend, one of the oldest agricultural shows in Australia's history. But over the years, the Southern Highlands farming scene has changed dramatically as the region moved away from dairy, quite significantly, and into livestock, and increasingly also into equine pursuits. The ABC's Nick Reinberger broadcast from the show, and he spoke to a local agronomist, Will Black, and also the CEO of the local barrel co-op, Mark Frond, about the region and the co-op.
A couple of years I've been in the job. It's, as I said, it's been an interesting ride, but very passionate about the co-op. It's in its 96th year here in the Highlands, which is quite an incredible achievement for a business in the local area. So, and we're also very passionate about supporting the agricultural industry. So it's and we've sort of done a lot of work, especially since Will's come on over the last 6 months, in education to our customers in what the best products are to use, as well as the right information moving forward to get the best productivity out of your animals. So,
are you finding that there's more and more pressure on rural land? People want to subdivide it and sell it off, and it's no longer available for agricultural production?
Well, put it this way. If I had a couple of thousand acres here, there'd be a bit of pressure from my wife as well. I'll give you the tip. So.
Well, but you don't blame people. Oh, you know, they've got to look after their kids, and it's bloody hard to afford a house.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very much so. It's it's the Highlands has changed a lot over the last 20 years. I've been here my whole life. I was born in Barrow Hospital, so I've seen a big change over the Highlands over the last 46 years, sorry. But you can't blame people, but it is good to see that the people that are buying land down here are starting to get more productive with it and putting a bit more into it, which is good. Not to say our old traditional farmers never did, but they've sort of cashed in, got the good money, and headed out to sort of, which is building towns like Crookwell, Braidwood, all those areas where a lot of our guys have gone. So I'm married into a local dairy farming family, and same thing. They just a couple hundred acre block here, you can buy a couple of thousand acres somewhere else. So it's quite amazing how turned around. Yeah. But it's an interesting ride, because it goes up and down like a yo-yo, a bit like the cattle market at the moment too.
Will, tell me about the role of an agronomist and what you do.
Good question. My wife sometimes asks me that as well. What do I actually do? I guess we're trained in science. So we try and bring the best science to producers. In this area, it's really diverse now. We've changed from being a dairy growing area to, we go from goat farming to alpacas to
camels.
Yeah, there's a camel farm out here. There's truffles.
Camels.
Yes.
I would have guessed a lot of wine and truffles and especially cheesemakers. I would not have guessed camels.
You'd be surprised when you go for a drive, Nick, what you find around here. The objective's always the same: understand what the grower wants to achieve, and then try and bring the best science to help them achieve those outcomes.
Mm. So how are you seeing the kind of trends change in the demand on your services?
It's different clientele now. I mean, I think I got told, I've only been here 6 months, but I've lived here for 10 years. I think the co-op started with 300 and something dairy farmers originally. It was a dairy cooperative.
Yeah, and what have we got now? We've gone from 300 dairy farmers to five.
Yeah, we've got five left in the area. So I think it was, just under 300. Down to five major dairies.
So the co-op, when it originally started, was basically a dairy co-op.
It was a milk depot. It was on the other side of the railway line on Station Street.
On the old milk factory.
Milk cans used to come in by horse and cart, and then they moved forward a little bit and got a truck. My father-in-law used to drive the dairy truck for the co-op for a while. And, it's been quite an interesting change. Like I said, from being 100% predominantly that dairy co-op to now we're into a very, very large equine market in the Southern Highlands. But that's all part of, like, the property market and everything else around you. It changes, so you've got to adapt to the change and service the customers the best way you can.
Yeah. Will, are you finding you have to educate people that come here? They haven't been born into farming. They've bought in, you know, as a, not necessarily as a hobby, but, you know, maybe as a lady and gentleman farmers.
I understand exactly where we work together, Nick, perhaps is the
of
best
way to
put it.
Of course you do, yes.
There's a bit of education.
We're growing together.
Very good. Very good.
Slogan, yes. There's probably the big shift is people now are starting to look at practices in terms of sustainability. So
yes,
that's one of the big changes that we're addressing now, and whether that means a lighter touch on the earth in terms of chemical or fungicide use. The other thing that's changing is the use of technology. So technology is changing how we farm as well, which is good.
Well, you know, we've got drones that can monitor, and we've got drones that are so powerful they can spray a a field, really precisely, right? Yes. Absolutely precisely with no waste. You're finding that kind of stuff being
the
used
next,
here?
Yeah, I mean, the next bit is that we'll have cameras that will see the weeds and only spray where they see a weed, and they won't spray where they don't see a weed. So things are changing quickly. I think we know more, so we've got better science. Mm. So I think if we marry the two up, I think we're heading in the right direction. I mean, there's science is only our best guess at a single point in time. It changes
Fair enough. Yeah.
So I guess, you know, I see my role as marrying the two and making sure that we can remain productive for hundreds of years to come.
That's the CEO of the local barrel co-op, Mark Freund, talking about the region and the co-op. And we also heard from local agronomist Will Black. And staggering those figures there, used to be 300 dairies in the Southern Highland region, and now there's just 5, and the co-op originally set up as a dairy co-op, but of course they're involved in a whole range of other things now. You're listening to The Country Hour. Shortly we'll have a look at the weather details, and we'll also have some news headlines in a second as well. But before we do that, getting a few texts on the fire ant issue. Someone's texted in saying, I don't know whether they're serious or not about this. They're saying we should release a heap of anteaters to eat up all the fire ants. There you go. That's an idea. I've probably thought about that one already. But Dave says, here we go again. We've stuffed up big time with varroa mite and the bees. Now the fire ant eradication program is not being handled efficiently. It's not good enough, says Dave. So, and there's also Troy's texted in saying fire ants, varroa mite. He says also around Kempsey, they've got the tropical soda apple as well. He says it's a rolling catastrophe, and it's a failure by council, DPI, LLS. He said a whole range of people involved in the failures there. So that's just your thoughts on the fire ant issue. It's coming up to 28 minutes to one. Shortly we'll have some weather, as I said, but first some news headlines with Sarah Gerethy. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. There's hope the price of a range of ordinary household goods might fall in the coming months as hundreds of tariffs are axed. The federal government says the cost of certain goods in Australia, like pens and toasters, should drop slightly. From July, tariffs will also be axed on sanitary products, white goods and clothing. A senior official at the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees in Gaza says talks with the Australian government on lifting a suspension of funding are ongoing. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says he's taking advice after Canada and Sweden restored their funding for UNRWA over the weekend. A study by the New South Wales Bureau of Crime Statistics and Research has found that judge alone trials are more likely to result in not guilty verdicts than jury trials. The study compared acquittal rates for more than 5,800 trials finalised in the state's higher courts between 2011 and 2019. And Hollywood's biggest stars have gathered in Los Angeles to celebrate the year's best accomplishments in film at the Oscars. Oppenheimer is the most nominated film of the night, but so far black comedy Poor Things has racked up the most wins. And there'll be more news in half an hour.
And just on that, just getting on the wires, is just saying Robert Downey Jr. has just received the Best Supporting Actor Oscar and he's giving his acceptance speech right now, and he says he'd like to thank his terrible childhood.
Wouldn't we all? Wouldn't we all? I mean, look, if you can make something out of a terrible childhood and go and win
there
an Oscar
go.
Out of it,
win
that's
an Oscar.
I think you're winning all around. But yeah, I think thanking your childhood, even if it's good or bad, is always a good way to go. Certainly,
he,
in the Oscar
he also
speech.
Had some pretty troubled times between these teens and into his late 20s as well.
I think that was the more notorious period. But anyway, look, it's a story of somebody who's triumphed against the odds, I guess.
And, bit of redemption.
Got himself clean. A good redemption story, which the Oscars love, right?
That's right. Fantastic. There you go. Robert Downey Jr. So I hope I didn't spoil it for people that are wanting to find out the details later on the TV. Thanks for that, Sarah.
Thanks, Michael.
You're listening to The Country Hour. It's coming up to 25 minutes to one. Let's find out what's happening with the weather details. And it's staying hot, Juan Park, by the sound of things, for the inland, even for the next 4, maybe 5 days.
Yes, that seems to be the story because of the slow-moving weather patterns promoted by a slow-moving high-pressure system over the Tasman. And with that, we will be seeing low to severe intensity heat wave conditions across the south, and perhaps continuing on for the next couple of days at least, with the maximum temperatures reaching mid to high 30s, about the southern inland and in the far west. And similar maximum temperatures expected about the same area for tomorrow as well. but the southeastern district may see some mild temperatures from the later part of Tuesday into Wednesday because of a weak southerly wind change associated with a trough entering the state's far south. That will shift the heat bit further northward from the southern inland into the central and the northern part of the state. Otherwise, the whole state should remain dry for the next couple of days, including today and tomorrow, apart from some coastal showers expected along the north coast. Then the current weather pattern will break and the trough in the south will strengthen and become mobile and move across the central and the northern part of the state between Thursday and Friday as a south to southeasterly wind change. This will bring a fresh southerly wind change along the coast and mild temperatures and wet conditions across the east through the second half of the week with the potential for moderate falls in some parts of the east. So changed weather patterns expected during the second half when in the east, but states west may also receive some rainfall in the form of isolated showers or thunderstorms, but don't expect much because much of the rainfall will be focused in the eastern side rather than the west.
Right, okay. So staying fairly warm west of the divide and maybe a bit of a change affecting more of the eastern part of the state by the sound of things.
That's right, yes.
And much rain in it for on the coast?
Along the coast, maybe widespread 5 to 10 millimeters expected, but some
so
parts,
not a huge amount, someone will get something.
Yeah, but some parts may receive a bit more, maybe potentially 30 plus millimeters. Quite possible on some days. Maybe in the southeast on Thursday and central parts on Friday and shifting to the northeast on Friday as well on Saturday. And with this shifting of focus rainfall areas, those areas may potentially see some isolated totals of 30 plus millimeters.
Right, okay. And for the inland, so temperatures still staying in the high 30s or it's going to moderate a bit?
Unfortunately, the temperatures in the west will remain fairly warm to hot, so expect the temperatures to remain around the mid to high 30s across the outlook days. But the main focus of the heat will be firstly starting from the southern inland, and then in the south we expect some cooling with these southerly changes that will moderate the temperatures to about high 20s to low 30s, but this heat, on the other hand, will be migrating to the northern inland parts, and so with that, through the second half of the week, we may see the temperatures in the northern inland parts remaining in mid to high 30s during the latter part of the week.
Oh, okay, and so no major sort of change in terms of the moving through the inland in the forecast period.
That's right, yeah, because unfortunately, although these southerly changes will flush the heat across the east, but the central part of the continent is still warm and the inland part will be under the influence of these warm to hot air masses centered around the central part of Australia. So with that, you know, we are not really looking at the proper relief of temperatures in the inland parts.
Okay, all right, well, that's good to we'll have a case of the divided state again over the divide, as people will talk about it quite often. Thanks for that, Juan.
My pleasure.
It's coming up to 22 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Now, a few texts coming through. Philip from Armidale says, when it comes to biosecurity, the Queenslanders only do anything when someone else is paying for it, and usually that's New South Wales. Also, on the Southern Highlands, someone's texted in to say the Southern Highlands and the pressure for hobby farms and less dairy. This trend is as much a result of poor land use planning as it is about land values. Local planning rules allow subdivision for lifestyle into non-viable lots for farming. However, if the land is held in areas that do have urban encroachment, at least there is a chance of protecting agricultural resources for the future. That's not progress, says Nick. And also, this is not strictly related to our program, but in terms of the news, Someone's texted in to say, on the cost of living issues and taxation relief issues, I think that socks and undies are coming down, but pens, paper and pencils are stationary. It's 21 minutes to one here on the Country Hour.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Meat processors will be required to install video surveillance systems throughout their facilities by 2026 under a change to the Animal Welfare Certification System. Now, the Australian Meat Industry Council, which oversees the system, announced a mandatory requirement this morning. The system's voluntary, but around 85% of processors are already signed up to it. AMIC Chief Executive Patrick Hutchinson says video surveillance has widespread support.
In conjunction with other organisations and getting their advice, we've been progressing for a number of months now. We have decided by 2026 that the installation and utilisation of video surveillance from unloading through to slaughter will be a mandatory undertaking within that program.
Why do you think that's important?
Well, this is a evolutionary process, not revolutionary. It's been something that we've looked at for some time. A number of our members utilise video surveillance within other parts of their business. So we've looked at, you know, the opportunities, what the technology is at the moment, how it's going to be able to be used and utilised. And felt that, you know, for this program and for this standard, that the addition of this was not going to be overly onerous, but does assist those people who are signed up to the program to ensure that they can review and have systems to be able to review their programs and underpin what we are expecting from them as organisations who are part of that standard.
I know there has been talk or calls in some quarters for things like video surveillance live streamed for public access, but in this case, who will actually have access to the video footage?
Yeah, we've heard that too, and of course there's no other business in the world that actually undertakes that or provides that, and I'm not talking about processing, I'm talking about any business. You've got workers' security and privacy that needs to be looked at as well, which we know animal activists don't really care about. This is, as I said, more about the utilisation of the material for training and education and review.
An important point to make, I think, is that while you're making video surveillance mandatory under the Animal Welfare Certification Scheme, not all processors are part of that scheme?
That's correct. So it represents roughly about 80-85% of all red meat throughput in Australia. The reason being is because a number of customers demand it. So it's reflective of them demanding this standard and demanding the outcomes to this standard.
Do you expect pushback from individual processors on this?
No. We've done our research. We've worked with our members. We've utilised and provided a heap of information. There's a lot of support coming from organisations, as I said, like who are interested in and who are dedicated to animal welfare, such as RSPCA.
And these video surveillance systems, they'll have to be up and running by 2026?
That's correct. They'll start to be audited under the Australian Animal Welfare Certification Scheme by that stage.
And just finally, I note that you're also reiterating the calls you've made a few times for that zero tolerance policy on vigilante groups trespassing into processing sites?
Absolutely. I think that, again, we need to reiterate, which, you know, the common and, I mean, which the sensible people out there will understand completely, is we're not doing it for them. These people aren't interested in animal welfare. They go into these sites in order to ensure to, say, stop eating meat, taking videos out of context. I think that all of those things have been very well reviewed and spoken about in the media over the last 18 months, 2 years. They've only actually invaded one facility that is operating under the Australian Animal Welfare Certification Scheme, and the independent group which oversees that certification scheme suspended that facility in 48 hours. However, every other facility they've ever invaded is not an AMIC member, and is not part of the Australian Animal Welfare Certification Scheme. So the key thing here is that they pick their targets exceptionally well. They pick their targets that are underpinned by state governments, and state governments need to pull their socks up and respond to this sort of process, because basically good animal welfare puts these people out of business.
Patrick Hutchinson is the Chief Executive of the Australian Meat Industry Council, and he was speaking there to Angus Verley. It's a quarter to one.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
China has overtaken Indonesia to be the biggest buyer of Australian wheat, but as wheat prices fall to a two-year low, it seems unlikely the Chinese buying will push up prices. Andrew Whiteley says world production of corn and soybeans are keeping the prices down, and the Northern Hemisphere harvest is getting closer and supply may actually increase further. He says there's still a question mark over how successful Chinese farm production is at the moment as well. He says China is likely to be a big buyer of grains in the short and medium term, so taking over as the biggest buyer of Australian wheat is not a surprise.
No, no. I think the last couple of years we've just seen this real big rise in the amount of grain that China's importing, not just wheat, but you know, barley imports, corn imports, wheat imports have just been going absolutely bonkers into China, basically since the start of COVID, which is really interesting. I think this is something we've spoken about before, Michael, in that China always says that they've had a bumper crop. In fact, I think this week the Chinese Minister for Agriculture came out saying that it was going to be another bumper crop over in China, which, surprise, surprise, is probably the 10th year in a row that there's been a bumper crop out of China.
Yeah, I heard him say that, and I just disbelief.
I think it's they must have the best science and the best farmers in the world, because they keep creating records. And look, Australia's created, you know, 3 years in a row of good crops this decade, but China, I think, is on its 10th or 12th year of record crops. But that's what makes it more interesting, is that they're producing these record crops, but the volume of imports is dramatically increasing. So, you know, just to give you as a sort of good example, you know, prior to 2020, China was overall imports, not from Australia, but just overall imports of wheat from all over the world, was sub 4 million tonnes.
Mm.
Last year, it was about 12 million tonnes. So a fairly substantial rise, and in the last couple of years it's been around that 8 to 12 million tonnes since 2020. So big, big licks of grains, and that's where a big chunk of it has come from Australia. Traditionally, you are right, Indonesia used to be the biggest destination for our wheat, but the last 2 years we've seen a substantial rise in China, and China has become the number one customer for our wheat overall.
Talking about the barley situation, whether there was worry about all their eggs being in the one basket, and wheat as well. So, you know, are we going to be too focused on China?
Look, again, grain is going to go to whoever is going to pay the best price, and we do have a lot of issues around diversification of our grain exports. And obviously, barley, we know that China is the biggest buyer of barley in the world nowadays, and they're going to continue to be buying big licks. This year, so far, since the tariff has been removed, it's been about, you know, 70 to 80% of all the barley that we've exported has gone to China. Wheat as well, like wheat is obviously now heavily swinging towards China, with Indonesia in second place and then Philippines in third place. But we actually, if we look a bit further afield, and if we look at things like canola, our canola is actually heavily skewed towards Europe. And in fact, if we look at sort of Europe as one nation, we're as heavily focused on them as we are with barley into China. So we do have this across most of our agricultural commodities, or grain commodities at least, is a heavy reliance on one or two sets of clientele.
Talking about the Indonesia-China sort of issue, does it mean that the Indonesians will have to start paying more for our grain and the Chinese? There might be a bit of a bidding war there between the two of them.
Fingers crossed. I think this is a good thing about, you know, China being a big buyer. When they're buying in these sort of really big volumes, what that does is take away from the overall global supply, which means that countries like Indonesia, which clearly have, you know, huge growing populations, and they've got an inelastic demand, so they are going to have to buy, you know, grain from other places.
And they like our white wheat too.
Absolutely, but they're going to have to bid up for it.
Mm.
And that's what markets do, is it goes to the highest price, and China is the highest price at the moment. If Indonesia wants to continue buying, then they'll have to pay up. And I think that's the key thing, is that, you know, what we want is for people to be buying our grain and making it harder for other people to buy it in order to make them pay up for it.
But the price of wheat has been heading south.
Price of wheat's been heading south. A couple of factors around that. Things like we've got a big corn crop coming off, or big corn supplies. But we've also got a big Black Sea crop. A lot of that Russian, Ukrainian wheat is hitting the market, and that's putting a lot of pressure on things. But I would say, still a long way to harvest, and anything can happen between now and then.
Andrew Whitelaw is an analyst with Episode 3. It's coming up to 9 minutes to one on the Country Hour. Well, for the first time in 6 years, canola is moving by rail out of Cropper Creek and North Star. A strong season last year produced enough to fill about a dozen trains, and they've just started heading along the inland rail down to the port. Josh Connell is the head of supply chains with GrainCorp.
Well, obviously, the process through inland rail came through, a collection of some flood damage and track issues put us out of action. But after a little bit of a journey, it's really nice to see that inland rail is hooked up and we're back loading again, and now successfully moving the first train loads of canola out of Cropper Creek and North Star that would normally probably move by road up into Brisbane.
Yeah.
They're going to find a destination.
So not only getting canola on trains, but also heading a different direction. I guess before we get to going down to Newcastle, what's the canola crop been like up in that Cropper Creek district?
It's been certainly emerging and growing. It's formed a pretty valuable portion of the rotation for a lot of that area, anywhere from sort of Gundawindi to down the Cropper Creek Golden Triangle area has been growing more and more every year. I think the issue for them they've been is that been a little bit captive in their market. There's a very small demand for it up into Brisbane, and so naturally it makes its way south to a crush or to export somewhere. And so because of the distances, it's potentially been, and I don't think it's affected prices, but it's been a little bit more difficult to move. But now we've got a pretty good alternative that moves a lot of canola in a very quick manner and efficient manner, and it's really exciting.
Yeah, tell me what it was like. Were you there, or what feedback did you get when that first train sort of headed out recently? How much canola did you have loaded up there to head down to the Port of Newcastle?
So we're roughly, the trains at the moment are about 48 wagons. So depending on the rail supply and the type of wagon, it can vary a little bit. And we're putting about a payload of about 55 tonnes on each one. So roughly 2,600 tonnes of train moving in one go. Talking with the team on the ground, you know, they're loading the train about 4.5 hours, which is pretty good. To put that back into equivalent of road trucks, you know, there's probably close to double the number of road trucks. So there'd be, you know, somewhere between 70 and 90 trucks.
Josh Connell is the head of supply chains with GrainCorp. It's time for markets. Corowa Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon. Agents penned a total of just shy of 9,600 sheep and lambs for a mixed quality yarding. A small buying group were in attendance, operating in a softer market. Heavy trade lambs slipped $4 to $7, selling from $128 to $168, averaging 575 cents per kilo carcass weight. Heavy lambs 27 to 30 kilos eased $3, 161 to 190, and extra heavy export types were unchanged, 193 to 203. Light lambs to the processor sold from $36 to $94. Feeder lambs between 18 and 24 kilos sold from $100 to $124. Trade weight merino lambs slipped $14, 88 to 127. Mutton sold to mixed trends. Heavy merino ewes eased $2 to $10, selling from $55 to $87. And heavy crossbred ewes gained $3 to $12, selling from $44 to $73. I'm Caroline Ronald for MLA at Corowa.
Dubbo Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon. The lamb numbers increased to 19,000, but the quality was plainer. There were more light lambs and secondary trades offered, along with a very limited supply of heavyweights. Hoggets were again in good numbers. The market trend is firm to cheaper, with quality and condition the driver. Two score processing lambs are firm, 73 to 120. Trade weights are 7 to 10 cheaper. 20 to 22 kilos, 113 to 140, 22 to 24 up to 144, an average between 570 and 590 with the very neat shorn trades out to 660. 24 to 26 kilos, 142 to 177, 26 to 30, 159 to 188, and these average 620, are back around $15 on average. The extra heavies are firm, 180 to 225. The few very heavy hoggets are 10 to 20 stronger, 120 to 148. And this has been Graham Richard.
To Wagga Cattle.
Good afternoon. The hot, dry autumn led to the larger yarding of 6,000 head. Cattle prices have slammed on the brakes as processors and feedlots operated at significantly lower levels than before. The cow market took the hardest hit, with heavy cows dropping 40 to 45 cents, while leaner grades faced a correction of 50 to 70 cents. Heavy export steers and bullocks tumbled 20 to 30, but additional buying orders just before lunch helped steady the market. Prices have ranged between 236 and 312. Heavy feeder steers improved slightly, but remain 20 cents cheaper. Feeder steers in all categories slipped by 40 to 50 cents, with lighter weights being hit the hardest. Medium weight steers sold between 240 and 339, averaging $1,360. Feeder heifers also felt the brunt of the cheaper trend, slipping by 40 cents to 50, with lighter weights averaging $905. Lightweight weaner steers, 200 to 280 kilo, dipped 50 cents, with plenty of sales between $700 to $800. There's no trade cattle 400 to 500 kilo yet sold, and only Andax for MLA.
Let's go to Forbes cattle now, Crystal Ridley.
Numbers lifted this hour with agents yarding 1,280 head. Quality continues to be mixed, with some handy runs of well-bred cattle on offer, along with those secondary types. The usual buyers are present, competing in a cheaper market. Yearling steers slip 10 to 20 cents a kilo, with those to feed selling from 285 to 349, with the better types to processors ranging from 278 to 320. The heifer portion followed a similar trend, with numbers limited. Feeders paid from 245 to 293, with a few better types to processors selling from 230 to 290. Heavy steers and bullocks are 20 to 25 cents easier, receiving from 270 to 300. Grown heifers sold from 222 to 270 cents. Cows dropped 30 cents a kilo, with the heavy 2 score from 190 to 214. 3 and 4 score receiving from 208 to 226. This has been Crystal Ridley at Forbes from LA.
And finally to Tamworth cattle now and James Armitage.
Than if you were selling a plainer quality yearling. Despite a reduction in supply to 1,680 head, quality was very mixed in front of the usual buyers, where processor demand was subdued. There were some bright spots in the market, but not much positive price change. Restocker steer weaners were considerably cheaper, 296 to 368 cents a kilo. The best of the heifer weaners made 305, much cheaper trends. The medium and heavyweight yearling steers, 400 to 480 kilos, were least affected. Medium weights 300 to 362, up to 480 kilos, 300 to 358. The best quality medium and heavyweight yearling heifers saw little change, much cheaper the balance. Medium weights sold from 216 to 322, with the heavyweights reaching 334 cents. The weaker processor demand saw heavy grown steers cheaper, 246 to 300. Plain conditioned cows, 168 to 234. Heavy 3 and 4 scores as much as 30 cents cheaper, 215 to 242 cents a kilo. James Armitage for MLA in Tamworth.
And no Bendigo today because of the public holiday in Victoria. You're listening to the Country Hour. Before we go, last word goes to a few people on Fire Ant. Peter says it's interesting that David Littleproud blames the Queensland government. He said it was a failure on his part as a Minister for Agriculture when he was in government in regards to the Fire Ant issue. And Ron in Leeton has texted in to say Fire Ants have been here since 2014. He says we subsidise the fossil fuel industries of over $10 billion a year, but we only give a lousy $490 million to get rid of Fire Ants. Ron from Leeton says it's nothing like getting your priorities right. You're listening to the New South Wales Country Hour. It's coming up to news time, 1 o'clock.